Commander Rappard, Reel 13. Now, after the briefing conference, what exactly happened then? You'd move into the Sicily operation. How do you remember the event?
I remember being slightly overwhelmed by the thought of what we had to do and how many people were involved and where the convoys were coming from and so on. And focusing really upon the task we would have, since we were apparently going to lead in some of the landing craft towards the beaches. But when we set off from Malta, all this was terribly secret, and one couldn't talk about it until we were actually at sea. And we went, I think, north-east from Malta in order to meet the convoys coming up from the Alexandria end of the Med. And these convoys were not just merchant ships. Some of them were the, I think they were called landing craft infantry, LCIs, and they were comparatively small for seagoing. And there was a bit of a breeze blowing up in the Mediterranean. And when we first came upon them in full daylight and saw them plowing on in the general direction of Sicily, they were taking the seas quite heavily over the front end, and I felt terribly sorry for the soldiers on board. In their circumstances, we were on the screen, as usual, and one was anticipating that somebody would start attacking us sooner or later from the air. But I don't remember now that there were any shadowers, and there were certainly no attacks as we gradually approached. The landings were going to be after dark, and we were told that we were to be led into the beaches by, I think, midget submarines or submariners of some sort who had were going to place little blue lights facing out to seaward. And as we, under the shelter of Sicily from the west, the sea was calmer because we were rather nervous about the landing craft having to land if it was as rough as it was further out to sea. And it was remarkably peaceful as they approached. Well, I knew that glider troops were to be landed behind the beach defenses in order to take the eyes off the ball of the people actually on the beaches. And as far as we knew, there were only Italian troops in the area. However, as we went in, we saw the gliders being tugged in, I think, by Dakotas, overhead in the failing light. And we were horrified to realize that some of them, at least, were being dropped into the sea, and that instead of landing behind the defenses, they were, in fact, landing between the defenses, the landing craft were moving in. So we were getting a bit lost ourselves, I think. But we took the some of the landing craft in the general direction of the right beach, and we found at least one of them we had misdirected. I think they went too far north, and they had to come back parallel to the beach. As we got a mile or two off the beach defenses became alert, and searchlights came on. And the exact timing is not clear to me now, but at one stage I could see the landing craft being illuminated by these searchlights. And from the angular point of view, there are only a couple of degrees between where the landing craft were and where the searchlights were. And the captain said, "Do you think you can put out the searchlights?" So I said, "Yes, we had a chance of doing so, but we might hit our own people, so we didn't know whether they were on the beach or not." So I had a go, and luckily the first salvo put the searchlight out. So the landings went ahead, and we had no actual targets once the searchlights were out. There was some gunfire going on from behind the beaches, but we had no forward bombardment liaison officers with that particular operation, as we did later at Salerno. So it was all pretty hit and miss. And quite obviously, it was an opposed landing, and the beach defenses had not been put off. We could see a lot of gunfire going on. Come the dawn, we were still at action stations and still waiting to be attacked by the air. We couldn't understand why we hadn't been. But the destroyers were put on an anti-submarine patrol, a sort of secular patrol, well out to sea, about 8 or 9 miles out to sea, because we felt that somebody, somewhere, would be coming in to try and attack the very large number of supply ships that were unloading stores and supplies and guns and ammunition, everything the army needs when they're trying to fight a battle ashore. And we had a comparatively peaceful day. There was the odd aeroplane did turn up, German aeroplanes. But during the evening, as the dusk set in, we could see way out to sea the bright red cross over the top of the hospital ship, one of the two hospital ships, I could only see one, way out to sea, about 10 miles out. And quite suddenly, I saw gunfire from an aeroplane, tracer bullets from an aeroplane, obviously very low down and obviously shooting at the hospital ship. And as I was high up in the Tata, I could see it further than people a bit lower down. And we raced over towards this incident as fast as we could. And then we saw an explosion of a bomb, great shower of sparks and all the rest of it. Quite obviously it hit the hospital ship. And we were at action stations, of course, but we didn't see the aeroplane at all, didn't come our way. When we got over to the hospital ship, she was down by the stern, and they were evacuating the casualties from down below. The drill, obviously, was that in order to avoid casualties just floating away and being dispersed for when anybody came round to help pick them up and rescue them, they were being secured by light lines to the after taffrails of the hospital ship, which I found out to be Talamba, SS Talamba, with Alaska crew, I think, and of course all the hospital facilities and nurses and so on, doctors. As the wards down below were being evacuated, I could see that it was getting more and more difficult for them to get the casualties up the various ladders inside the ship, and they were quite clearly getting more tired as this happened. And as she was going down by the stern, it began to be apparent that unless somebody quickly started to think about loosing these lines which secured the one-man stretchers, each of which had a little red light on it so they could be seen more easily, there was going to be another sort of disaster. The boats hadn't been lowered at that point, but somebody was getting the idea that they should put casualties in the boats. And I watched a lot of casualties in one boat with a nurse, and the Lascars were lowering the boat, but the Lascars on the afterfalls let them run free, so the boat swung down and hung vertically. And the casualties, who couldn't help themselves, poor devils, in the boat, all went into the sea. But the nurse hung on to a lifeline. And although it was very calm, there was a slight swell, and the Talamba was rolling a little bit in the swell, and so the boat acted like a pendulum and gradually crushed to death the girl who was holding on to the line until she dropped into the sea, and quite obviously was no good when she did go in. There were those by then who could swim, who were swimming. We were only about 150 yards away from the ship. They were swimming across to us, and we had lines and Jacob's ladders and all the ways of trying to get them inboard if they were able to help themselves. And I could see as she was slowly going down that the lights on the individual life rafts with the wounded men in them were being pulled under one by one. And it was a dramatic and horrible thing to see. Then it was apparent that a bulkhead or something down below was going, because there was a puff of smoke out of the funnel. And she was obviously changing the angle and going further down by the stern. And some of the portholes on the port side of the ship, on our side of the hospital ship, were obviously leading into the wards down below, whence the casualties were being evacuated, and it had become too steep for them to get out of it. And one or two of the girls stuck their heads out of these portholes, which were too big to get their shoulders through, too small to get their shoulders through. And they knew that they were going down with the ship, and they were screaming blue murder, poor devils. And there was absolutely nothing we could do about it. And it gradually went, slithered away, stern first. All the little lights that had been floating around went out, and we were just left lighting up the sea beside us with people swimming in it. Not many of them anymore. We'd got a lot of them out by then. We were still at action station, so I was still up in the gunnery director, very high up, and therefore able to see all these things. And the noises which we'd been listening to, and the awful screams, and the breaking up of the ship itself, were suddenly succeeded by silence. There wasn't even much wind. And it was a vivid contrast. Well, we had so many survivors on board that there were too many for us to fight the ship effectively. They were in the way. And the time came, it was about 2 a.m, I suppose, by then. We broke down to a lower degree of readiness, and I was able to get out of the director and go down aft. And I found that one of the 6 nurses we'd picked up out of about 30 in the hospital ship had been put in my cabin on my bunk. There was nobody in there with her, and I didn't know she was there when I went into it. And she was totally distraught, poor girl. Sodden, of course. And she was only concerned to know what had happened to her friends. You know, is Mary all right? What's happened to Lucy? I was trying to reassure her and trying my vast inexperience as a 22-year-old or whatever I was by then, trying to be soothing and calming to this girl who was probably a couple of years older than me, or thereabouts, a similar age anyway. And I hadn't had to deal with a girl in that state before, and certainly not a survivor like that. But in order to fight the ship, we had to get rid of the survivors. So while we were doing that, I went forward and through the mess decks to see what was happening down there, and I found that some of the people we had on board had been in the gliders the night before. They'd been chucked into the sea. They'd survived that when an awful lot of them didn't, because they had so much equipment on. They then had to do an opposed assault landing. One or two of them had been wounded. They'd then been evacuated to Tolamba and operated on, and then been thrown in the sea again for the second time in about 36 hours. And the fact that they were alive at all was quite astonishing. And the thing which impressed me, and is still with me vividly, is the way that our ship's company were turning into nursemaids, into really feeling people, looking after these poor devils who were in such a mess. They would give them absolutely, they were giving them clothes, they were drying them, they were sitting and listening to them, they were trying to talk to them, and they were dishing out cocoa or whatever was being provided by the galley all night, of course, for them. And we took them over to the headquarters ship, and Bulolo, I think, was her name, and we unloaded the casualties on her while it was still dark, and then went back on our patrol. I had a bit of sleep, but we had to fuel the next day because one always needed to be ready if there was a chance to fuel, you did. And we were one of 2 or 3 ships that were alongside the tanker when a whole lot of Junkers 88s arrived. And they were obviously going for the tanker, and going for us as a big agglomeration of ships alongside the tanker. And I couldn't fire on the side they were diving because it was would have shot away the tanker's upper works. And the captain just cut the wires or slipped them, and we got underway as quickly as we possibly could. And as we got underway, we were straddled with bombs, so that a huge gouts of spray came up on either side, and once more I got a wet shirt from bomb splashes. But I was able to put up a barrage on their side away from the tanker, so that if they were diving down towards us, when they pulled up anyway, they'd have to go through our barrage. And a little while later, as we got underway again, another raid came in, and Tata shot down two of those, fairly long range, both Junkers 88s. One of them disintegrated and fell into bits into the harbour, or the anchorage. And the other one had an engine fire on the port engine, and managed to come down under control and land on the calm sea. And I was looking at all this through very large binoculars from the director control tower. And I saw the crew get out, and they got onto the wing, and I didn't get around to stopping the guns firing and killed the lot. And the vividness that I was still seeing what had happened the night before was overwhelming. It's not a thing which I can justify in cold blood umpteen years later. But it satisfied the ship's company. There was no doubt about that. And there wasn't a man in my director's crew who was saying, oh, we better stop or anything like that. So although we were bombed from time to time, we had other concerns. And indeed, two events happened. I wanted to find out if there were any stores ashore, and so I went ashore to Augusta, I suppose it was, and went into the captain of the port's office, because I knew that something had gone wrong with the landing of the cooks and stewards and administrators who were going to look after the port, and that the designated captain to run the show had in fact turned back when he was fired on. He didn't think the cooks and stewards were the best people to make an opposed landing in a port. ABC, it's the Commander-in-Chief Mediterranean, Andrew Cunningham, had immediately relieved him of his command and ordered his second-in-command to bloody get on with it. The second-in-command happened to have been my divisional officer at Dartmouth, where I'd joined Michael Tufnell. And Michael had a very rough time in the Channel as commanding officer of a 100-class destroyer. And I knew that he'd eventually been unable to take his ship to sea because he'd been in floods of tears one morning when his first turn reported ready for sea. So he was put ashore, and the first turn took over the hunt and took it to sea. And Michael had gone to some form of hospital for a year or so to get over this. And then he'd been sent to the planning job in Cairo, and the second in command of a port party in Sicily seemed a nice, quiet number. But he found himself having to take cooks and stewards in and teach them how to fire their rifles on the way in, I think. Anyway, he was there and beginning to do his administrative job when I went to see him in this totally strange Italian place. And I knocked at his door and went in there. And to my considerable horror, I found him holding his revolver with two hands and pointing it at me and wobbling. So I reminded him who I was and that it was all right and this, you know, things were still all right. And he realized that he'd made a mistake. And I did get some stores out of the system. But I was intrigued subsequently. I believe he commanded a carrier after the war, and he also was officiating in Buckingham Palace when I went to get my OBE many years later. I'd always called him Tuffy, or referred to him as Tuffy behind his back when I was a cadet, because he was a lieutenant and I was the lowest form of pond life around at the time. But we liked him very much indeed when we were in his division at Dartmouth. But it was fascinating to meet him again in those circumstances. Well, having had problems once before when the Mediterranean had been invaded from the west and we'd gone into Algeria with lack of fresh fruit, I found that the fruit, a lot of the fruit ashore, was still on the trees. So, with the permission of my captain, I took a foraging party ashore in Sicily, and we came back with a boatload of oranges and lemons and you name it. We had lots of fruit. What we didn't know was that either the fruit had been sprayed with something nasty, or else it wasn't fully ripe, because the next day the heads were overused in the ship in a very big way indeed. While I was ashore foraging, my godfather had called on the ship. He'd seen the ship was in harbour. He was a member of the London Scottish that had landed in Sicily. So he came off to see if he could find me. And unfortunately, I missed him that time, but I caught up with him a couple of days later. And the London Scottish, the next time I saw him, was on a landing craft going across the Straits of Messina, waving from his landing craft while we went by. But there was much fighting to happen all the way up Sicily before we went across the Straits, of course. And one of the excitements that Tata became involved in was protecting a monitor which had come, I think, been used in the Yangtze before. They had one 15-inch turret, and they were very small. They had nothing else. Their only reason for existence was to have an enormous great turret. They were very slow and not very maneuverable and had no anti-aircraft defense, or virtually none. And we would go off and watch them bombarding ashore by day. And by night, we were trying to stop communications from the northern part of Sicily getting down to the south by the coast road past Catania. And we knew that there was a railway gun up there. And the railway gun lived in a tunnel in the cliffs near the coast. And we were very keen indeed to stop this railway gun, which was quite a powerful, large caliber gun. And we were, in fact, caught. We were ambushed doing this because we were about 3 miles offshore, I suppose. And the gun would pop out of its tunnel, and we'd fire furiously at it, and it'd pop back into its tunnel. And then we'd sit there waiting like a cat outside a mouse hole for it to come out. But instead of the gun coming out again, we suddenly heard the noise of E-boat engines starting up under the shadow of the cliffs and coming for us. So we skedaddled as fast as we could and found we were fighting an E-boat war, which was quite different, so we couldn't see them. And up against the cliffs, we weren't getting clear radar picture of them either. So it was exciting stuff. It was also, I think we added to the ruins of Cagliari a bit, or whatever, the Catania rather, a bit, the Roman ruins there. But we did eventually push the opposition out of Sicily, and the question was, what were we going to do next?
Do you remember much about the engagement with the E-boats? Did you use the same...
In that particular... And I didn't use the same system that I had before south of Sicily because we didn't have good radar echoes and I couldn't treat them like aeroplanes. And in any case, I had the other sort of ammunition loaded for shooting at railway guns in tunnels, which were not quite the same. Our hearts beat a great deal faster there until we got away from them.
Did you ever manage to get the railway gun?
I think we probably brought the entrance to the tunnel down. But I never got ashore, and I would love to have gone ashore and had a look to see the result of all these things. Now, one of the features of life at Malta, before we started off for Sicily, had been that we'd been given a soldier to liaise with us, who was a gunner. And his job, he was called the Blow, which stood for a bombardment liaison officer. And our Blair was a delightful man, and we realized that he was going to be parachuted into somewhere, which turned out to be near Salerno, and that he was going to direct our gunfire from shore somewhere behind the enemy lines. So we practiced with him at Malta. And in due course, when we set off from Sicily to... deal with the Italian thing, we found that he was going to be dropped on the hills above Salerno. Meanwhile, we've been trying to disrupt communications in the southern toe of Italy. If you go through the Straits of Messina, you'll see on your right-hand side there are coastal railway lines going along. And we had the greatest fun shooting at trains going along these lines, which really could be given a course and speed like a ship. And we had great success with one or two trains at night. Sometimes they stopped and everybody got out and ran away. Sometimes they didn't have time to stop. But it did disrupt communications by rail at that bottom end. However, there was a new invasion plan, and we were obviously going to leapfrog up the Italian coast towards Salerno, just south of Naples, south of Capri. And the orders for that clearly involved a joint force with American ships as well as British ships. Quite a lot of bombardment stuff and some carriers. And we got up to about halfway up there in the middle of the night when we heard the broadcast, which was put through on the ship's loudspeaker system, the fact that Italy had dropped out of the war. So what had clearly going to be a very hairy operation indeed. We thought, good, this is going to be a walkover. And we relaxed a bit, although not from defending against undersea warfare and all that sort of thing. However, when we actually got there, we found we'd been very badly mistaken. That although the Italians weren't playing ball anymore, we'd run into a very large force of Germans just behind the beaches at Salerno. And the soldiery had a very rough time indeed. Now, this was a clearly planned operation. We had an airfield or fields in which fighters could land and be refueled. What we didn't know was that there was going to be so much operation, so the timing was going wrong. And a second new feature arrived, and that was the guided bomb. It was a German device which clearly could be dropped from considerable height and was then controlled in some way on its flight down towards us. And I think one of the American cruisers caught one, and there were one or two others. And we were told with an emergency signal that the way to deter these things was to tune into a certain frequency and run an electric razor by the microphone, which might put it off, which seemed wildly improbable, but we were prepared to try anything since it was rather frightening. The business of trying to deal with reinforcements coming south over the hills north of Salerno began to involve our bombardment liaison officer. And he gave us a lot of targets to fire at up in the hills there and on the main roads. And then he told us that, in fact, the Germans were working their way up the hill towards him, and that we were then trying to shoot at them, and he gave us the positions to drop our shells. And the last thing we heard from him was that we should drop shells on his position, because he was being overrun, in effect. We didn't hear any more about him. I never knew what happened to him. I imagine he was killed or taken prisoner. The counterattacks the Germans launched on the beaches were very impressive indeed. They had installed a battery of 88mm guns which had been dug in, and there were some rather attractive beach houses, resort type of houses along the beach, bigger than beach huts, proper houses for living in, and right on the sea, with the flat plain behind and the hills on the left leading up towards Vesuvius and Naples. The fighting was definitely not in our favor. I could see, we were close enough inshore to see the color of the uniforms involved. But where I could see the khaki uniforms, I wasn't shooting at them, but I began to see the gray uniforms coming down and taking over the beach houses.